But what if even a thirst for truth could distract from the truth himself, standing here in their midst while they searched for him in books and test tubes? I did not know. And next to his unutterable love, my own bewilderment, all the questions I wanted to ask, seemed incidental. Perhaps, I concluded at last, he cannot tell me more than I can see, perhaps there is nothing in me yet that could understand an explanation. The central fact, the all-adequate one, remained this personality at my side. Whatever additional facts he was showing me, he remained every moment the real focus of my attention. Which is why, perhaps, I was not aware of the precise moment when we left the surface of the earth. Up until this point I had had the impression that we were traveling, though in what manner I could not imagine, upon the earth itself. Even what I had come to think of as a higher plane of deep thoughts and learning was obviously not far distant from the physical plane where bodiless beings were still bound to a solid world. Now, however, we seemed to have left the earth behind. I could no longer see it. Instead, we appeared to be in an immense void, except that I had always thought of that as a frightening word, and this was not. Some unnameable promise seemed to vibrate through that vast emptiness. And then I saw, infinitely far off, far too distant to be visible with any kind of sight I knew of, a city. A glowing, seemingly endless city, bright enough to be seen over all the unimaginable distance between. The brightness seemed to shine from the very walls and streets of this place, and from beings that I could not discern, moving about within it. In fact, the city and everything in it seemed to be made of light, even as the figure at my side was made of light. At this time I had not yet read the Book of Revelation. I could only gape in awe at this faraway spectacle, wondering how bright each building, each inhabitant, must be to be seen over so many light years of distance. Could these radiant beings, I wondered, amazed, be those who had indeed kept Jesus the focus of their lives? Was I seeing at last ones who had looked for him in everything? Looked so well and so closely that they had been changed into his very likeness? Even as I asked the question, two of the bright figures seemed to detach themselves from the city and start toward us, hurling themselves across that infinity with the speed of light. But as fast as they came toward us, we drew away still faster. The distance increased, the vision faded. Even as I cried out with loss, I knew that my imperfect sight could not now sustain more than an instant's glimpse of this real, this ultimate heaven. He had shown me all he could, now we were speeding far away. Walls closed around us. Walls so narrow and box-like, that it was several seconds before I recognized the little hospital room we had left what seemed a lifetime ago. Jesus still stood beside me. Otherwise consciousness could not have sustained the transition from infinite space to the dimensions of this cell-like room. The glorious city still sparkled and glowed in my thoughts, beckoning, calling. With total indifference I noticed that there was a figure lying beneath the sheet on the bed that nearly filled the minuscule room. But incredibly Jesus was telling me that I belonged somehow with that sheeted form, that his purpose for me involved that lump-like thing as well. I was moving nearer to it. It was filling my field of vision, shutting off the light. Desperately I cried out to him not to leave me, to make me ready for that shining city, not to abandon me in this dark and narrow place. As in a long ago half-forgotten story, I remembered myself combing the halls and wards of this very hospital, wanting desperately to find the figure on this bed. From that loneliest moment of my existence I had leapt into the most perfect belonging I had ever known. The light of Jesus had entered my life and filled it completely, and the idea of being separated from him was more than I could bear. Even as I pleaded I felt consciousness slipping from me. My mind began to blur. I no longer knew what I was struggling for. My throat was on fire and the weight on my chest was crushing me. I opened my eyes but there was something in front of my face. I groped about the blankets, trying to find what was covering me, but moving my arms was like trying to lift lead bars. At last my fingers closed upon each other. With my right hand I touched a circular band with an oval stone on the ring finger of my left hand. Slowly I twisted it round and round, as blackness closed over me. Part 7. It had taken 4 sessions to relate this much of my story to Fred Owen. Throughout, he had stopped me to ask questions or offer interpretations, and to let me know he was not necessarily buying a word of it. Now, however, he sat absolutely still, while on my desk the numbers on the digital clock flipped over. I heard the outer door open and close as my next patient arrived. I looked at the clock. We had 10 more minutes. You had returned to your body? Fred asked at last. That's the way I interpret it now, I said. At the time I didn't know much of anything. For the next 2 or 3 days I was pretty much unconscious. Just some feverish, nightmarish kinds of dreams, the kind of thing you'd expect with a serious illness. That was the main thing, I told him. When I began to be conscious again, I was mostly conscious of being sick. My physical problems crowded everything else out of my head. But while I had been out of the body, I did not know how else to describe it. There was no pain. No physical feeling of any kind. The next thing I could recall for sure, I went on, was opening my eyes with a mammoth headache and seeing a nurse smiling down at me. It's good to have you back with us, she said. For a while though we didn't think you were going to make it. I licked my fever-cracked lips. What day is this? I rasped out. This is Christmas Eve, Private Ritchie. Holiday leave for the hospital staff had been cancelled, she added, because of the influenza epidemic and a heavy incidence of pneumonia in the camp. I tried to think of another question so she would not leave. Somehow I had to communicate to her the thing that had happened to me. Yes, she said, they had snow almost every day. Her name, she told me, was Lieutenant Irvine. I've just had the most astounding experience, I plunged in. Something everyone on Earth has to know about. A coughing attack seized me. Lieutenant Irvine had to get her arm under my back and prop me up to give me a drink of water. Don't talk any more now, she said. I'll look in on you later. And actually, I wondered, what was I going to say? I've just seen God. I've been to hell? I've had a glimpse of heaven? She would think I was crazy. All that week, whenever anyone came into that little room, I tried to describe the light that had filled this very space, and the all-essential question he had asked. I never got beyond the first few words. Get some rest now. Don't try to talk. The doctor or nurse would say, and indeed my voice was no more than a gasping croak. The staff was obviously more interested in matters like my metabolic rate, my temperature, the amount of intravenous fluid I was getting. It was evident from the attention I was getting that this was considered more than a routine case. And gradually, as the days passed, I pieced together what had happened on the hospital floor during the time when I, on my side of the event, was meeting Jesus. Our time's up for today, I told Fred, but tomorrow if you like I'll tell you what I found out from the doctors. Fred was coming daily now, though even the short walk from the parking lot left him breathless. So it was the following afternoon that I resumed my story. 7. It had taken 4 sessions to relate this much of my story to Fred Owen. Throughout, he had stopped me to ask questions or offer interpretations, and to let me know he was not necessarily buying a word of it. Now, however, he sat absolutely still, while on my desk the numbers on the digital clock flipped over. I heard the outer door open and close as my next patient arrived. I looked at the clock. We had 10 more minutes. You had returned to your body? Fred asked at last. That's the way I interpret it now, I said. At the time I didn't know much of anything. For the next 2 or 3 days I was pretty much unconscious. Just some feverish, nightmarish kinds of dreams, the kind of thing you'd expect with a serious illness. That was the main thing, I told him. When I began to be conscious again, I was mostly conscious of being sick. My physical problems crowded everything else out of my head. But while I had been out of the body, I did not know how else to describe it. There was no pain. No physical feeling of any kind. The next thing I could recall for sure, I went on, was opening my eyes with a mammoth headache and seeing a nurse smiling down at me. It's good to have you back with us, she said. For a while though we didn't think you were going to make it. I licked my fever-cracked lips. What day is this? I rasped out. This is Christmas Eve, Private Ritchie. Holiday leave for the hospital staff had been cancelled, she added, because of the influenza epidemic and a heavy incidence of pneumonia in the camp. I tried to think of another question so she would not leave. Somehow I had to communicate to her the thing that had happened to me. Yes, she said, they had snow almost every day. Her name, she told me, was Lieutenant Irvine. I've just had the most astounding experience, I plunged in. Something everyone on Earth has to know about. A coughing attack seized me. Lieutenant Irvine had to get her arm under my back and prop me up, to give me a drink of water. Don't talk any more now, she said. I'll look in on you later. And actually, I wondered, what was I going to say? I've just seen God. I've been to hell? I've had a glimpse of heaven? She would think I was crazy. All that week, whenever anyone came into that little room, I tried to describe the light that had filled this very space, and the all-essential question he had asked. I never got beyond the first few words. Get some rest now. Don't try to talk, the doctor or nurse would say, and indeed my voice was no more than a gasping croak. The staff was obviously more interested in matters like my metabolic rate, my temperature, the amount of intravenous fluid I was getting. It was evident from the attention I was getting that this was considered more than a routine case. And gradually, as the days passed, I pieced together what had happened on the hospital floor during the time when I, on my side of the event, was meeting Jesus. Our time's up for today, I told Fred, but tomorrow if you like I'll tell you what I found out from the doctors. Fred was coming daily now, though even the short walk from the parking lot left him breathless. So it was the following afternoon that I resumed my story. Part 8. After I collapsed in front of the X-ray machine, I learned I had been taken to a small isolation room in a nearby ward where my condition was diagnosed as double lobar pneumonia. Over the next 24 hours, in spite of all the hospital could do, in 1943 miracle drugs were still in their infancy, my condition deteriorated. Early in the morning of December 21st, 24 hours after I had been carried unconscious to the little room, the ward boy making his regular rounds to hand out medication, arrived at my little cubicle and failed to find a pulse. He checked my respiration rate. None. Next he took my blood pressure. Again, none, at which point he went running for the officer on duty. The OD arrived on the double and re-ran the tests himself with the same results. At last he straightened up. He's dead. All right, he told the ward boy. When you finish your rounds, get him ready for the morgue. He spoke heavily. Already there had been a number of deaths at Camp Barkley that month. Reluctantly he straightened my arms along the blankets, pulled the sheet up to cover my face, and returned to the ward to do what he could for the living. The ward boy, too, continued on his rounds. And that must have been the point at which I, in my desperate disembodied search, arrived back at that little room and saw a figure covered with a sheet. Approximately 9 minutes later, according to the hospital records, the ward boy returned to the little room to begin prepping the body for transfer to the morgue. But, surely that hand on the blanket has moved. Again the ward boy went galloping for the OD. The officer returned with him, examined me a second's on time, for the second time pronounced me dead. Doubtless the young orderly on their long, lonely night shift was imagining things. And then occurred the event the full impact of which only registered with me years later. At the time I learned of it I was surprised certainly, but not dumbfounded as I am today each time I think of it. The ward boy refused to accept the verdict of his superior officer. Maybe, he suggested, you could give him a shot of adrenaline directly into the heart muscle. It was unthinkable, in the first place, for a private to argue with an officer, especially on a medical matter when the private was an untrained ward boy and the officer a licensed physician. In the second and place what the ward boy was suggesting was medically ridiculous. In those days before widespread use of cardiac massage and electric shock, adrenaline injected into the heart was, it is true, occasionally attempted in cases of heart arrest. But this was only done when the heart had stopped because of some trauma to a basically healthy patient, like a drowning accident, where getting the heart started again holds out some hope for ultimate recovery. But when the entire system has deteriorated from an illness like pneumonia, simply getting the heart muscle to contract a few more times achieves nothing. Technically, you may get a heartbeat for a few minutes, but you have not altered the overall condition. Indeed, my condition, any medical man would have known, was totally irreversible. After so long without oxygen, the brain would be hopelessly damaged. And yet this knowledge of a low D, fully aware of the unreasonableness of what he was doing, AC accepted the suggestion of the uninformed enlisted man at his side. Get a sterile pack from the supply room, he told him. When the ward boy reappeared, the officer filled the hypodermic from a vial of adrenaline, then plunged the hollow needle into my heart. Erratically at first, beating resumed. Then as the two watched, incredulous, it settled into a rhythmic pulse. A moment later respiration commenced. My blood pressure rose. My breathing grew stronger. It was by no means an instant recovery. It was 3 days before I was conscious, 5 before I was off the critical list, 2 weeks before I was walking. But only now, with 27 years of my own medical practice behind me, can I appreciate the bewilderment with which the staff must have followed my progress. By the time I was well enough to ask questions, both the officer on duty that night, and the ward boy whose unaccountable hunch proved correct, had shipped with a unit bound overseas. But I received a personal visit from Dr. Donald G. Francy, the commanding officer to whom the OD had reported the events of the evening. Dr. Francy called my recovery the most amazing medical case I ever encountered, and in a notarized statement years later wrote, Private George G. After I collapsed in front of the X-ray machine, I learned I had been taken to a small isolation room in a nearby ward where my condition was diagnosed as double lobar pneumonia. Over the next 24 hours, in spite of all the hospital could do, in 1943 miracle drugs were still in their infancy, my condition deteriorated. Early in the morning of December 21st, 24 hours after I had been carried unconscious to the little room, the ward boy making his regular rounds to hand out medication, arrived at my little cubicle and failed to find a pulse. He checked my respiration rate. None. Next he took my blood pressure. Again, none, at which point he went running for the officer on duty. The OD arrived on the double and re-ran the tests himself with the same results. At last he straightened up. He's dead. All right, he told the ward boy. When you finish your rounds, get him ready for the morgue. He spoke heavily. Already there had been a number of deaths at Camp Barkley that month. Reluctantly he straightened my arms along the blankets, pulled the sheet up to cover my face, and returned to the ward to do what he could for the living. The ward boy, too, continued on his rounds. And that must have been the point at which I, in my desperate disembodied search, arrived back at that little room and saw a figure covered with a sheet. Approximately 9 minutes later, according to the hospital records, the ward boy returned to the little room to begin prepping the body for transfer to the morgue. But, surely that hand on the blanket has moved. Again the ward boy went galloping for the OD. The officer returned with him, examined me a second time, for the second time pronounced me dead. Doubtless the young orderly on their long, lonely night shift was imagining things. And then occurred the event, the full impact of which only registered with me years later. At the time I learned of it, I was surprised, certainly, but not dumbfounded as I am today each time I think of it. The ward boy refused to accept the verdict of his superior officer. Maybe, he suggested, you could give him a shot of adrenaline directly into the heart muscle. It was unthinkable, in the first place, for a private to argue with an officer, especially on a medical matter when the private was an untrained ward boy and the officer a licensed physician. In the second place, what the ward boy was suggesting was medically ridiculous. In those days before widespread use of cardiac massage and electric shock, adrenaline injected into the heart was, it is true, occasionally attempted in cases of heart arrest. But this was only done when the heart had stopped because of some trauma to a basically healthy patient, like a drowning accident, where getting the heart started again holds out some hope for ultimate recovery. But when the entire system has deteriorated from an illness like pneumonia, simply getting the heart muscle to contract a few more times achieves nothing. Technically, you may get a heartbeat for a few minutes, but you have not altered the overall condition. Indeed, my condition, any medical man would have known, was totally irreversible. After so long without oxygen, the brain would be hopelessly damaged. And yet this knowledge of a low D, fully aware of the unreasonableness of what he was doing, accepted the suggestion of the uninformed enlisted man at his side. Get a sterile pack from the supply room, he told him. When the ward boy reappeared, the officer filled the hypodermic from a vial of adrenaline, then plunged the hollow needle into my heart. Erratically at first, beating resumed. Then as the two watched, incredulous, it settled into a rhythmic pulse. A moment later respiration commenced. My blood pressure rose. My breathing grew stronger. It was by no means an instant recovery. It was 3 days before I was conscious, 5 before I was off the critical list, 2 weeks before I was walking. But only now, with 27 years of my own medical practice behind me, can I appreciate the bewilderment with which the staff must have followed my progress. By the time I was well enough to ask questions, both the officer on duty that night, and the ward boy whose unaccountable hunch proved correct, had shipped with a unit bound overseas. But I received a personal visit from Dr. Donald G. Francy, the commanding officer to whom the OD had reported the events of the evening. Dr. Francy called my recovery the most amazing medical case I ever encountered, and in a notarized statement years later wrote, Private George G. Riches. Virtual call from death and return to vigorous health has to be explained in terms of other than natural means. 9 At the time, however, I told Fred Owen, the details of my recovery interested me very little. I regarded my return to this life as a calamity, would have been angry, if I had had the strength, with those who labored to revive me. Mostly I just lay in bed, a very sick young man, wrestling with the immense encounter I had had in that very cubicle. Thinking of Jesus. Wishing I knew how to tell others about him. Wondering how I could live where I could not see him. The times when my separation from him seemed easiest to bear were when somebody came into the room. Ward boys, nurses, doctors, it did not matter, my heart gave a leap whenever someone appeared. Lieutenant Irvine, Retta was her first name, I found out, though of course I never dared use it, was especially faithful about looking in as she put it, and each time I tried again to tell her what had happened to me. It was like the brightest sun you've ever seen, only not a burning sun. The trouble was I lacked words to express even the faintest part of it, and I could see that my attempts only puzzled her. Thinking back, I realize Retta Irvine could not have been more than 26 or 27, a pretty blonde with a trim figure and a delectable smile, but to my young eyes she seemed practically middle-aged, an older woman to whom I could pour out my troubles. Since I could not make her understand about the light and the worlds he had shown me, I told her about school and how I was to have started classes 3 weeks before. That she sympathized with at once. It was great, talking to her. To look in a human face and have her look at me, to speak and see her react, why hadn't I realized the wonder of it before? As soon as I was able to totter unsteadily out to the main ward, my spirits improved still more, and I began to pester them into moving me to one of the regular beds where I would have people on both sides of me. I was amazed, remembering myself as I had been up to this experience, a shy, rather introverted person. Only in scouting and in the FIGAMS had I been at ease with other people, and that was because I had been with the same group, day after day. Now suddenly I found myself greeting total strangers like lifelong buddies. The utter aloneness I had known as I roamed these same wards unseen, unthought of, had made a deep turnabout change in me. When lights went out each night and conversation died away, I would lie staring at the row of nightlights across the aisle, thinking back over every detail of that extraordinary night when light itself had entered this drab wooden barracks. Was he still here? I wondered. Was it only because he was too dazzling for physical eyes that none of us could see him? I had grown discouraged about even attempting to tell others what I had seen. Discouraged and a little self-protective, too. I was enjoying the newfound companionship of the ward too much to risk being ostracized as an oddball. But for hours each night, I would recall every sight, every sound of that incredibly vivid time. First that hellish realm, where I had been permitted to look longest. Where people who no longer belonged to the earth could not escape it either, could not escape the involvements, the hungers, the pride they had allowed to dominate them here. Then the brief visit to a realm where ego had been left behind, where all was selfless search for truth, where I might almost have thought myself in heaven except for the final fleeting revelation. The glorious city. I had seen it for an instant only, yet of the whole experience it stood out clearest. Most achingly. What did it all mean? Why should such things have been shown to me, of all people? Above all, what was I supposed to do about it now? That was the question Fred Owen was asking, slumped in the armchair next to mine, timing his words between labored breaths. Did it make any real difference? In your life, I mean. In what you did. Otherwise it's all very fascinating, having an inside track to God and all that, but I can't see that it matters very much. An inside track. Did I detect a note of envy in those words? If so, it was obvious I had failed to get across the essence of the experience. This was no round trip to heaven, I reminded Fred. If I saw heaven at all, it was only at an enormous distance, unattainable by the person I then was, or could conceive of becoming. Nor did I believe that as a boy of 20 I had peered into the depths of hell. I had not seen, for instance, the lake of fire recorded in the Bible. But what I saw of the next life, as it was apparently being experienced by people very like myself, was hell enough. Enough to fill me with a lifelong terror of any attitude, habit, priority that would nine, at the time. However, I told Fred Owen, the details of my recovery interested me very little. I regarded my return to this life as a calamity, would have been angry, if I had had the strength, with those who labored to revive me. Mostly I just lay in bed, a very sick young man, wrestling with the immense encounter I had had in that very cubicle. Thinking of Jesus. Wishing I knew how to tell others about him. Wondering how I could live where I could not see him. The times when my separation from him seemed easiest to bear were when somebody came into the room. Ward boys, nurses, doctors, it did not matter, my heart gave a leap whenever someone appeared. Lieutenant Irvine, Retta was her first name, I found out, though of course I never dared use it, was especially faithful about looking in as she put it, and each time I tried again to tell her what had happened to me. It was like the brightest sun you've ever seen, only not a burning sun. The trouble was I lacked words to express even the faintest part of it, and I could see that my attempts only puzzled her. Thinking back I realize Retta Irvine could not have been more than 26 or 27, a pretty blonde with a trim figure and a delectable smile, but to my young eyes she seemed practically middle-aged, an older woman to whom I could pour out my troubles. Since I could not make her understand about the light and the worlds he had shown me, I told her about school and how I was to have started classes 3 weeks before. That she sympathized with at once. It was great, talking to her. To look in a human face and have her look at me, to speak and see her react, why hadn't I realized the wonder of it before? As soon as I was able to totter unsteadily out to the main ward, my spirits improved still more. And I began to pester them into moving me to one of the regular beds where I would have people on both sides of me. I was amazed, remembering myself as I had been up to this experience, a shy, rather introverted person. Only in scouting and in the Phi Gams had I been at ease with other people, and that was because I had been with the same group, day after day. Now suddenly I found myself greeting total strangers like lifelong buddies. the utter aloneness I had known as I roamed these same wards unseen, unthought of, had made a deep turnabout change in me.